welcome to a special edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. We are going deep. We're going to throw the long ball. We're going to talk all things Syracuse lacrosse in honor of this special anniversary, this 100th anniversary of their men's college program. I'm Bob Carpenter, founder of Inside Lacrosse Magazine. And when people talk about SU lacrosse, it often goes beyond the stats and the championships. They talk about the personalities. They tell a whole lot of stories. In preparation for the May issue, which is in large part dedicated to this 100th anniversary, I asked Terry, our publisher, Terry Foy, if we were overdoing it. 18 pages of content in season, and I remember Terry just kind of laughed and shrugged and said, "It's Syracuse." And I kind of laughed and shrugged as well. This program is in a class of its own in so many ways. And here for the website, what I will do is a series of interviews with famous players and personalities who have worn Syracuse orange. The first guy I spoke with is a defenseman's defenseman, meaning if you're a professional lacrosse player, if you're at the top of your game, if you're a big-time coach, Pat McCabe is a guy that you look up to. Pat McCabe is a guy whose skills you respect if you are a pro defenseman in your own right. When Pat speaks at this centennial banquet, his delivery, his demeanor, he's very polished. He appears very calm. But make no mistake about it, on the lacrosse field in the late 80s, Pat McCabe was a holy terror. When you went to buy a ticket to go see a lacrosse game in the Carrier Dome during that era, of course, you want to see fireworks from the Gate Brothers. You want to see John Zilberti bouncing around and doing a roll dodge and catching the ball behind his back, and Maracek throwing 25-yard behind-the-back passes on a rope. But people used to go pay the price of admission to watch what was happening at the other end with this tough kid from Elmont. He wouldn't just put the ball on the ground. He would put the stick on the ground. I can't think it would be that much fun to have to play against this guy. Pat McCabe was a four-time All-American. He won 3 national championships. I believe he was 2-time Defenseman of the Year. He was on Team USA. He was on Under-19 Team USA. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's pretty much the man. I caught up with Pat on the road. There's a little static on the line, and we float through a wide array of topics. But he is an interesting guy, and it was an honor to interview him. So let's see what this Syracuse great has to say.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for making the time here.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I really appreciate it. I've paid attention to what you've been doing for a long time, and I appreciate everything you've done for the game. So this is very easy for me.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun to watch your team relive all these memories. A lot has been made of the words style and art when talking about the way Syracuse played, but usually those types of descriptions are associated with offensive players. In your era, style, art, those words applied to long poles as well, the crazy takeaway checks and the freewheeling nature of your game. Did that come organically, or do you practice that stuff the same way that the offensive players do?
No, I would work. You know, I think every one of us, you know, that's the thing that gets lost on some of the success we had. People think it came easily, and it didn't. We worked very hard every day, and we were, you know, most of the time, the best team we were going to face all season was the one we faced, you know, Monday to Friday. So that allowed us to really expand our games, and we had to work hard in order to compete. You know, our practices were so competitive in a good-natured way, and we went after each other really hard, whether it would be, you know, an upstate, downstate game, or, you know, the offense getting after the defense, and depending on who was having a better day, who was whooping it up and, you know, having a little fun at the other guy's expense. But me personally, you know, I worked pretty hard to understand my opponent. I worked hard to understand their rhythm and their timing and the cadence of the way they cradle and move the ball. And, you know, guys who were predictable and, you know, reactionary to, you know, a stick check or a poke check, I found to be easier to, you know, take advantage of. A guy who was, you know, a little bit more of a herky-jerky guy who didn't move very much was more difficult for me. So I knew I had to put my time into studying my opponent a little bit and watching film and, you know, taking maybe the first two or three possessions with a guy who I wasn't familiar with to just watch how he cradled and watch how he reacted when my stick moved. And I would put that in the bank for, you know, later in the game. And hopefully by the time it got a little bit later, I had him figured out. So if I needed to go into that and get the ball from him, I could, you know, prey upon his reaction a little bit and figure him out and put the ball on the floor and hopefully get it to, you know, some pretty good offensive players who made us look real good.
When you figure someone out, you know, like when you're in a boxing match, when you figure out how to land a punch, do you know that you've got him for the rest of the game?
It depends on the guy, Rob. You know, there'll be certain guys where, you know, if you get them that first time, you've got them for the rest of the day. There are guys that you have to be careful because if they get that first goal, they're going to be a handful for the rest of the day. So it depended on the player. It really did. And as you move along in your career, and this is what I try to explain to young people all the time, you're going to face the same guys for the rest of your life. So, you know, I was fortunate enough to play against Timmy Goldstein, Dennis Goldstein, Matt Panetta, you know, guys who were all-time greats, and I had to face them again and again and again. And there were days that were mine, and then there were days that were theirs, and we had a great give and take. And it's really not as simple. There are guys that, you know, many people have never heard of that gave me nightmares. Like, they were just a tough matchup for me. Billy Miller's a very well-known guy, but people don't talk about Billy as much anymore. You know, Billy was one of the most dynamic athletes on a lacrosse field I've ever seen. And he had such length, and he was such a good athlete, and his quickness, and he was very odd. Like, he didn't do things the way, you know, your stereotypical attackman would do. His movements were different. And he was a tough matchup, because if he got the one step on you, he was gone. You know, Dennis is a guy, Dennis Goldstein, who I had a lot of success against. And then later in our career, you know, especially our senior, he did a number on me. So, like, we had a great give and take. You know, I look at the matchups that I enjoyed. Like, I enjoyed the Matt Panetta matchup. We played high school together. He went to Hopkins. I went to Syracuse. From the second half of the 89 championship game on, you know, we matched up with each other. And we had fun with it. It was just a really good experience for both of us. We competed like crazy. And then when the game was over, it was over. And we, you know, we've always been friends. But I enjoyed that kind of stuff. I enjoyed what almost would be the camaraderie of being opponents. And that's why, you know, to this day, a lot of those guys I ran up against, we're still friends and still see each other in the summer and, you know, still run around a little bit as best we can. But those are special times.
So another thing that I want to hit on, there's a lot of things that you mentioned there that I'd like to go back to, but talking about the Hopkins rivalry, okay, that's the one, the Syracuse-Hopkins rivalry is the one that we all know the best. Dave Petromala, talking about the all-time great players, he's generally considered the man, the all-time great. You guys are contemporaries. You're both from the island. Was he a guy that, were you friends with him? Did he drive you from afar? Was there a rivalry between the two of you?
I would say my admiration as it relates to Dave is just how hard he played and how much passion he played with. But he still did everything fundamentally, like, perfectly. Like, if you watch him go over the head, it is the textbook of how to do it. When you watch him pick up a ball, it was perfect. I never saw him throw a ball away. You know, I never saw him miss a ground ball. I never saw him, you know, really struggle covering anybody. But the where Dave and I became friends was there was, you know, I had a fondness for him just because how much I admired his game, but he always seemed like a good guy. So after we lost to Hopkins, the first game of my sophomore year, a game that Simi still says we lost to Bon Jovi because we were supposed to play it at home and they scheduled the Bon Jovi concert in the Dome. So we had to go back to Hopkins and play back-to-back years. We had to go there. But we lose the game by a goal in an all-time great game that gets repeated in the final that year. And I decide to stick around and ride back with a friend of mine rather than go on the bus. And I went to Matt Panetta's house for a party. And when I walked in, I was the only Syracuse guy there. And I knew some of my friends from home were there, but I didn't really know many of the Hopkins guys, and I didn't know Dave personally. And I walked in the door, and he was all the way in the back of the house, and we made eye contact, walked in, and he kind of pointed it out to me and basically said, "Hey, get over here." And I walked to the back of the room, and we became friends right there. And we've been friends ever since. It was kind of like a guy who's got a little more mileage on and a little more experience happens to be on the wrong team. We're not on the same team, but we're on the same team at defense. And we became friends that night. And that was really I can still remember it pretty vividly.
You know, when you think about Petromala, it's like he's got defense in his blood. You know, you get the sense that if he's playing football, he's on defense. You get the sense that if he's playing basketball, he wants to play defense. Were you one of those guys that was begrudgingly forced to pick up a long stick because you were a good athlete, or was defense in your blood that way?
I as a hockey player and a basketball player, I was more of an offensive player. But I started playing lacrosse late, so most of my friends and the guys on the team, they knew what they were doing already. So quite honestly, in like eighth grade, when I go out for the team, I don't know anything. I don't know the rules. I picked up a long stick, and it was contagious for me, the feeling of, you know, knocking the ball from a guy. Back then, you know, the ball came out much, much more easily than it does today. But when you got, you know, the sense of timing, and you understood, and, you know, you could really put the ball on the floor or knock the stick out of a guy's hand, which I always loved, that was a great feeling. To me, it was as good as scoring a goal. It was winning your matchup. It was, you know, taking pride in winning an individual matchup that was really kind of intoxicating for me, I would say. I loved it. I still love it.
Do you think it would be less fun to play today with the sticks the way they are?
I don't know. I got to tell you, I think that the technology is part of it, but I also think that the defenders don't have enough freedom and don't go out and take the chances I was allowed to take. So defense is now played in more of systems than it was played than when I played. So, you know, now you cross check and you ride a guy down the side and you funnel him to where the help is, and you rely on six guys working together, which is wonderful. It's impressive to watch when you study it and you understand the game and the responsibility that each guy has. You know, so I go to Lake Placid or whatever, and we see each other in these places, and I still play my game. I still try to do what I did for all these years, and they're using today's equipment, and the ball will come out, not all the time, probably not nearly as often as it used to, but I think if guys were given the freedom to go after guys a little bit more, I think that you'd see the ball on the floor more than you do.
The thought of watching your era in lacrosse practices is great to think about. I'd love to be a fly on the wall. You know, especially I love the fact that the gates come in and you guys are watching these amazing players who you can't deny are going to change the sport. Like, they're that good, and their style of play is that great. And what was it like witnessing that before the rest of the world and knowing that secret before anybody else did?
Well, everyone talked about it. You know, I'm a year behind Gary and Paul, so I didn't have the kind of the warm-up that the rest of the guys on the team did. So when I got there, everyone's talking about them, and I'm just basically saying, all right, let's see what these guys are. I've seen a lot of good players, and let's see what it is. And the moment you get out there, it just looks different. The mechanics are different. The flair is different. The body type is different. Everything was different. But what really set them apart was how hard they worked. I mean, they just, you know, people think that they were just great. You know, I tell kids all the time, the greatest players are always the ones who work the hardest. and Gary and Paul and, you know, Tom Maracek, and, you know, we had a million guys that were really good. We all loved practice. So the practice was the time that was kind of like the lab where you would, you know, work on stuff and, you know, take different chances and see what would work and what wouldn't. But we, you know, we were as amazed as everyone else. We just had a little bit of a preview every day. So we got to see some of the excitement and some of the, you know, the variety that they would bring out in games, but they did it every day in practice. It wasn't like they just, you know, woke up on game day and said, "Hey, I'm going to try this." They were, you know, really hard workers and, you know, weren't afraid to experiment. We were encouraged to do that. So every day brought something new, and it was a lot of fun. And one of the things that I was always the most impressed about with Gary and Paul was they were the first rock stars. They really were. They were the first guys that whenever they went somewhere, everyone knew who they were, and it never changed them. They were still the same guys. They were still really good people and great teammates. It was the most impressive to me as I look back at it. As much as they were treated differently and as much as they were special, there was never a guy on our team who resented them and their popularity for one second. And that I think says the most about them.
You see them, you see what they're doing in practice. And a guy like, you know, a boy like me, I remember the breakthrough moment where it was all we were talking about was the Navy playoff game their sophomore year. I think Gary had just some crazy statistic that was just undeniable. It just jumped out in the newspaper. So when you're standing at the midfield line with one hand on the stick, like watching this performance, I got to think you're just laughing. I got to think it's you're just sitting there cracking up and shaking your head, watching it unfold for the public.
Well, that's pretty accurate to say. You know, Matty Taylor is a great guy to talk to about stuff like that. You know, he tells a great story about the 88 semifinal against Penn. We were struggling so mightily. You know, they had us figured out, and we couldn't get the ball in the goal. And we were getting frustrated on our end because what we would get frustrated about from time to time is when they would be going, you know, around the back and this and that and throwing it all over the place and it'd be going out of bounds. And then we'd be playing defense again. Like, we did it in practice every day, and the coaches just gave him another ball. They just like, give him another ball. And we in a game would say, yeah, give him another ball, but we got to play defense now. Can they please take care of it a little bit? You know? So we would get frustrated. So Matt Palin is standing there, and he's about halfway through yelling at the offensive end of the field, you know, you guys better get something going. And as he gets like going, finished out of his mouth, Gary dunks it from behind. And he basically looks at me and goes, yeah, like that. You talk about that Navy game after the game, and we're there, and all the Navy guys are there with us because we had a lot of friends and different schools, and guys were all friendly, and, you know, we were expected to win. And the goalie for Brown, for Navy, was a guy named Louis Brown, if I remember correctly. And he got up and he stood on a table, and he just, everyone looked at him, like the place kind of got quiet, and he's looking around and he goes, is anybody here not score on me today? And everybody laughed, and it was just a really good-natured, good time where we had one of those days where things just went right. You know, we just were on top of our game that day, and we were fortunate we had a lot of those days.
What stood out watching the Gates as a big attackman was not their blazing speed in the transition and their behind-the-back passes. It was the way they would dodge from behind, and they would just slam their body into the defenseman, create a gap, and then do an inside roll with this huge cushion that you just would never see exist for anybody else. And they could pull it off because they had a more whip in a pocket. You know, Craig Bubier could knock the guy back, but he couldn't do it and keep the ball in with the ball control that those guys did. Was that unleashed on you in practice? And do you agree that they revolutionized the way people dodge from behind?
I will tell you that pretty much everything you saw, you know, in a game happened to me and every other defender about 1,000 times more than you saw in a game situation.
Yeah.
So there's really nothing that they've ever done that a guy in my position didn't witness. But we used to do some stuff on Extra Man, and we used to run some stuff where, you know, Gary or Paul would either be down in the low left corner or they'd be coming from behind. And what I think has been missed, you know, not that it's been undervalued, but it hasn't been stated enough, in my opinion, is the great athletes that they are and the balance. I think the balance was one of the things that was the most impressive to me.
You mean the balance that you mean the balance on their feet. They had good balance.
Yes, yeah. Their strength and how difficult it was to knock them off their feet, and how Gary would be down in the low corner and he'd get a pass from Paul, a pop, and a guy would take a full run at him and he'd have his toes like on the edge of the crease line, and he'd fake twice while getting hit and not step in the crease. And their ability to balance themselves and that strength, that center of gravity, however it would be explained, they never got knocked in a way that made them like defensive. They were always in control of the physical matchup they were having. So as you allude to, like, their ability to come from behind and put their right shoulder into a guy's chest, and that guy was instantly on his heels, and they controlled that guy, and it was very impressive. What you're saying is absolutely right, and I don't think it ever got enough credit. I don't think I can count five times in total that the two of them combined got knocked down in 3 years I played with them.
And then throw into the mix the fact that they're getting double, if not triple teamed, right?
Yeah, and their bodies, in many situations, they were vulnerable. Their body was opened up. They were, you know, in a spot where, you know, maybe most guys would get really knocked to the ground. And I couldn't tell. I mean, look, you look back at film, I could be wrong. But I don't recall, other than one time, when a guy took a real cheap shot at Paul, I could not tell you that, like, they got, you know, blown up and taken to the ground, and they got hit all the time. Their bodies were a walking bruise after every game. Guys took liberties with them, and the other impressive part, aside from the athleticism and the balance, is the demeanor. They got beat up, and you saw it. They never got mad. They never went back at a guy. They never took a retaliatory penalty in all the time I saw them. As a teammate, as an opponent, as a fan, I never saw them do anything in reaction to another guy's cheap shot, and they took a million of them.
A million. And it's long past Syracuse, all through, you know, through a very long career in the NLL for Gary in particular. He was getting pummeled out in Colorado.
And he didn't get that respect that, like, a guy like Casey's getting a level of respect now playing that I think the young guys appreciate, you know, his tenure and the time and his contribution to the game. So I think there is a, more of a respectful treatment of him. Gary didn't get that till late. And Paul neither. Paul hung it up a little earlier because of injuries and that. But I don't think Gary got that kind of treatment until much, much later in his career.
I was asking Coach Simmons about this yesterday. Paul was so clutch, and it's very easy to have it be all about Gary. What was the difference between these two guys from your perspective?
Well, they played a bit of a different game. You know, Gary was more of a more of a placement shooter, more of a quick athlete. And Gary was more of Paul was more of a power player. Paul, you know, I always laugh, you know, when you watch that 89 game, when Paul gets the ball in his stick and he gets that left knee up and he winds up, it's over. You know, we used to laugh whenever Paul got the ball there and he got that left leg up in the air for that crow hop, there's nobody making that save. It's just not happening. You know, you could look at it. Once his knee got up, and I laugh because I tell people all the time, once that left knee got up off the, you know, got up to the, off the ground, and he got those hands back, you know, he could put it anywhere he wanted. but he just assumed put it through you, you know, if he wanted to. And that 89 game was so beautiful because those Nets were strung so tight.
I couldn't agree with you more. The way that there would be that like jitter through the entire cage,
right.
It would be like ringing a bell. And the soft Nets, just they're not as exciting.
No, it was great, Rob, because the ball came out almost as fast as it went in. So it was amazing. And, you know, you talk about my good fortune of being on the other end. That was some of the greatest moments when we're in like transition and it's going down and you see Paul trailing the play. And he's got that stick up, and, you know, whether it's Z or Maracek sees him cutting down, and he's not catching it and running to the goal and, you know, putting three fakes on and finishing. He's getting that right knee up in the air, his hands are back, and it is gone. And that thing came out so fast on each of those shots that day. And this is really what it got. I watched this recently. I was watching it with some of the girls at play, and I was showing them a couple of clips of this. I never saw Paul get so excited. He was so even keel.
Right.
He almost seemed embarrassed sometimes when he made some of these ridiculous plays.
Right.
And when you watch him score in that 89 game, every time he scores, he is on top of the world. And that was like one of those moments I look back at and I remember, I'm like, he's that excited. This is really big. Like for him to get that up, this is huge, and everybody followed him.
Well, let's transition that to the super excited Matt Palem. I mean, I just love the guy. I think he's one of the great personalities ever in the sport, and he's now kind of the elderly statesman at Syracuse wearing the suit and tie. You know, he was one of the most fiery goalies the sport has ever seen. What was it like to play with the guy?
Well, I'm one of the luckiest guys around, but Matt is so underappreciated from his playing career's perspective. You know, he played in an era with some of the greats, you know, Sal Acacio, Paul Smoller, Quinn Cusick, and no one talked about Matt Palem enough. What I always say is when I got to campus, I realized how little I knew about the game because all the guys I played with, especially the Central New York guys, they really understood the game. And Matt Palem was one of the smartest players I ever played with. He understood the mechanics of the game. He understood how things worked. He knew everybody's responsibility. And on top of that, the intellect, he was a really, really good athlete.
You hear about like a quarterback in the NFL buying Rolexes for his front line because that's his family. What type of like a little family within a family was created with a Syracuse defensemen and goalies?
He never got me a watch, if that's what you're looking for.
Get him up now that he's in doing
no, we had a good group of guys. I mean, we had some really got, you know, good personalities, and Matt was the glue. Matt was the guy who on our end of the field kept it together. He was, you know, if we made a mistake and a guy scored, he was never biting at us. He was never pointing a finger. You know, I like to watch some of the old stuff because anytime we gave up a goal, you know, and you see it all the time today, but it was a quick huddle. What did we do wrong? Let's figure it out. You know, it was not a blaming guy session where it was like, hey, you got to do a better job there. It was, listen, if you're having trouble with your matchup, do we have to help you quicker? You know, is there a way we can do this differently? And then when I always look at Matt, he was very mature. So I still remember in 89 when we won the championship, the last probably 20 seconds of the game, Hopkins comes up with a loose ball. They call timeout. We come out of the timeout. Things look a little differently. We call timeout. And then the play goes, you know, we get back out on the field and the play goes on. The game ends and we win. In the press conference after the game, I still remember what Matt said, and I was thinking to myself as a sophomore in college, I'm like, this guy's sharp. Like he sees it. So what he says is, you know, they come up with the ball, they call a timeout, they came out, they had Panetta with the ball. He just looks at the camera. The guy's asking, he goes, smart move by our staff. We called a timeout there to get ourselves reorganized. Like a guy, a junior in college, doesn't say things like that.
Yeah. And it now transfers onto the field again as a referee. I mean, he's down there in a pro football stadium packed with people, and I'll be standing on the sidelines in the Final Four. His intensity, but his poise and his it's a presence. He's in the moment. He's aware of everything that's going on. Like you said with that comment, you know, I think he's I don't know enough of the landscape of great referees, but I have to believe he's one of the best out there.
I agree 100%. And he's the same. He has the same approach as an official as he did as a player.
Yep.
He understands.
Yep.
He knows what's at stake. He knows how much it means to those kids on the field.
Yep.
So he prepares. He works really hard at it. And what I always liked, because I played long enough that Matt officiated my games, he would talk to you. So as a player, even though, look, we were teammates, we've been friends forever, it didn't matter if it was me or some kid who just got out of college. If the guy did it the right way and had a question or challenged the call, Matt would have a pretty honest conversation with you, and then he would cut it off. He would say, all right, it's enough. You know,
Yep. You
got your answer. Let's play the game. And he would go about it where everybody respected him, and I know they still do. I was relieved when I saw he was working a game. I was not the greatest guy as far as officials went, so they didn't love me all the time.
And you weren't relieved because, oh, there's a Syracuse guy that's going to give me a break. You were relieved because there's a guy that's going to call it fair.
No, I never worried. I never thought for a minute I was getting an advantage. He's too good a person for that. He would never disrespect the game in a way that he'd be trying to do a favor for me. I never even considered that.
Yeah, you know, you talk about the guys you played with, the guys you played against in practice, having a guy like Matt in the cage. You really have had a blessed career, right? But that's not even talking about the Bill Tierney in the World Games. You've had a coach in Coach Simmons that just instills confidence, and then you make the World Teams for another coach who's a mentor of mine who, you know, I've got incredible love and respect for Bill Tierney. He's famous for bringing the best out of his players. But obviously, polar opposite styles. Typically, you play for a set defensive structure in college. And then once you make Team USA, it's kind of an all-star team that goes out and, you know, freewheels it. You kind of had the opposite.
Well, my college experience was a lot of fun. And, you know, we kind of did our thing. And it's different because you're together every day. So that's a different experience. But then when I get the good fortune of making the 98 team and I play for Bill Tierney, that was an important time in my career because I had been out of college for quite a while. You know, I was a 91 grad. Now it's quite a few years later. I had started to slow down a little physically. I would say, you know, at that point I was probably, you know, I was almost 30. And I appreciated the system that he played. It had been so successful, and he had been, you know, such a person who made such great change in the game that I was looking forward to that. I didn't fully understand what I was getting into when I made the team, and that I didn't know Bill other than his reputation. And once I make the team and I start to play, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed being coached the way he coached us. He didn't coach us like we were college kids because I think he knew that would be unfair, but he was demanding on us. So I got a little bit of a different feel as far as system and style that way. But the thing that stuck with me, and this goes back to Coach Simmons as well, is you knew he cared about his players. So even though his style was a little bit different and the systems were a little bit different and there was more structure to it, the personal side of it, because I got to become friends with Coach Tierney during that time, because I had the good fortune of rooming with John DiTomaso, who was one of my best friends. And John and Bill go back to the Hopkins days when Bill was on the staff there. So that gave me an extra, a little extra exposure to Bill, because he would come in and talk to John. John was the elder statesman on the team, and Bill was always concerned with the temperament of the team and how are we doing and is he missing anything? Cause he really wanted to do a good job. And John and Bill would have those conversations, and I'd kind of just be another guy in the room. And from that point of view, they're the same people. The love of their players and wanting this to go as well as possible.
You're saying Coach Simmons and Coach T are the same people?
They're the same in the way they care about their players, yeah. And I don't think you can be successful, Rob, if you don't. And I think that's one of the things that gets overlooked with Bill Tierney a lot. I think you probably see it a little more now because it's a little more free-flowing at Denver, and it's just, you know, a different style of game. But I don't think you can have the success that either one of those men had unless your kids know you care about them and they really care about what they're doing for you every day. And I think that's something that the two of them had in common, and I think that's why they respect each other so much.
Well, give me something more granular. You're a coach now. What's something you learned from Coach T or Coach Simmons or Coach Desko? You know, we got to talk about Coach Desko as well.
Well, you know, what I learned from John, you know, when I got there, most of their defenders play a certain style. They would switch hands. If a guy was going on a right-hand drive, they would play right-handed. If a guy was going on a left-hand drive, they'd play left-handed. And I never did that before. And they wanted me to do that when I got there, and I couldn't do it. I got to tell you, I just had never done it before. I was completely uncomfortable. And I had to go in and talk to John and say, listen, I don't know. I can't do this. And we had a very honest conversation, and I said, if you just give me a chance, let me do it my way. I got here by doing it a certain way, and I, you know, give me a shot. Let me do it my way. And he basically looked at me and said, okay, and gave me a little feeling of confidence, like rather than saying, no, it's my way or the highway, he listened to me, and he gave me an opportunity to demonstrate that I could play my way and still do what was right for the team and still be effective. And he wasn't closed-minded. So I think from John, you know, John's a taskmaster, and John was always the guy in charge of the details. But John, he was willing to give me the chance to play the way I was comfortable, as opposed to just wanting me to fit his mold. And I think that served both of us well. So I think as a coach myself, you know, you want things a certain way, but if a kid is a little bit different, you have to be willing to be flexible and coach to your talent, as opposed to make your talent conform to your system. And John's willingness to do that with me made all the difference in the world in my career.
Coach Desko, I almost think he's almost a little bit like Gary and Paul when you're talking to him, very calm. And then he gets excited for sure on the sidelines. What I've heard is that, especially in the olden days, and especially against Hopkins, I heard that he would get really fired up before the team went out, and he was the guy that would like rile up the locker room. Are there any stories about the dynamic between Coach Simmons and Coach Desko?
Yeah, look, John. You know, John was a guy. You know, he wore the uniform. He cares about it so much, and those rivalries, you know, however you want to say it, spirited or the hated rivals, you know, whatever it is, those games meant a lot to him. They still do. So he would get fired up, you know, he would get going. And I would tell you his fire was more on display at halftime than it would be in a pregame. So we would get a speech from Simi before the game, and sometimes it would be inspiring. Sometimes it would be entertaining. He had a really great ability to gauge our temperament. So if we were too uptight, he would tell us somewhat of a ridiculous story that got our minds off playing for a minute. If he thought we were too loose, it would be something more along the lines of, you know, how to inspire us to go compete. And then if we went through that first half and we didn't do what we were supposed to do, then John was the one who got the ship, you know, steered in the right direction at halftime. He'd get it going. I still remember I was going to use this at the 100-year anniversary. Not that it would embarrass, but just it was just funny. And I was afraid he wouldn't take it the right way. We were playing UMass in probably 1990. And, you know, we're in the dome and we're probably winning by like 6 at halftime. He felt like we should have been winning by 10. And he goes in the locker room and he lets it loose. And he basically tells Gary and Paul, you're going to do it my way. Actually, what he said was, I don't care how loud they cheer when you do what you do. You're going to do it my way or you're going to sit on the bench. And he said it a little more adamantly and a little more colorfully. And we are sitting there going, holy cow, he just yelled at Gary Paul. Like, nobody yelled at Gary Paul. So the first face-off of the second half, Kirk Pratt wins the ball back. Paul picks it up. Gary had broken straight to the goal. Paul throws a pass to Gary, and you've probably seen this film. He throws it up high. Gary jumps high with his back to the goal, catches it lefty. With his back to the goal, he bangs it off the ground between his legs into the top corner. And that was how we started the second half after they got yelled at for not doing what he told them to do. So, you know, and you see Gary going back to the wing line for the next faceoff, and kind of like that Michael Jordan shrug, like, I can't believe everything's going in. He's kind of looking at the bench, like, shrugging his shoulders, going, what do you want? It's the only shot I had.
Is there an art to the pregame speech and the halftime speech that you have made a part of your repertoire?
I tell you, I get nervous once in a while because I don't think I do enough with the X's and O's in the pregame sometimes. I lend myself more towards the style of Coach Simmons, and my girls now, they kind of expect it. You know, there are games where I go in and I just basically say, you know, I got nothing for you today. You got to go play. Let's go. You know what we're supposed to do. I do spend time trying to gauge the temperament of my team, you know, every day, and determining, you know, do we need something here? Do we need inspiration? Is there something that might strike me during the week that will be useful that the girls can take and use as motivation or something that can kind of feed their fire a little bit? And sometimes it's just, you know, it's about inspiration and it's about entertainment. You know, make them laugh a little bit, make them have some fun, give them something to remember, because it's not just about playing the game, it's about the entire experience.
This has been a special edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Bob Carpenter, and be sure to pick up a copy of the May issue of Inside Lacrosse Magazine, where we take an up-close look at this historic team. Thanks so much.
Bob, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You're natural at this. You should get a podcast of your own.
Hey, you want to do something together, you let me know. I'm in.